enough that they had to reside. They basically got ignored. And that's part of the reason they got involved as well with the Germans. Because they fought.
Well, still, what I was saying is that those German nationals could not believe what had happened to their country. They couldn't believe how they lost control of everything. Because it was in the space of about, I guess, 2 years or whatever, after Hitler was elected, he had taken over everything. Everything. He was a dictator. And it was a democracy. But they completely lost all their freedoms. And they think, well, how did this happen? Somebody steps in and says, you know, we'll do it this way, do it that way, and it's a slippery slope. You lose a lot of freedoms.
Were the Kaisers before that, though? Before the Republic, or whatever you want to call it, democracy, wasn't it the rulers? They had all those Kaisers, I thought, which were rulers.
I don't know German history. I just know that this one documentary that has these Germans talking, they say it used to be this way, and it went from there to there, just like that.
And the people that live there must have seen it coming on, because my grandfather saw it coming on. So my grandmother, girlfriend, they got married. He came here for a year before Hitler came in power. So people were actually seeing it happen. Somewhere.
Well, I think, was it Wilt Chamberlain? I think he was probably one of the greatest idiots. Or he was the British guy that came back to Britain with the peace treaty with Hitler. I think that was Wilt Chamberlain that signed that. Trying to kill Peter.
Neville Chamberlain. No. Wilt Chamberlain is a basketball player.
I know.
How did we get on basketball?
Yeah, I was like, wow.
Neville Chamberlain, yeah, he was the prime minister, and he tried to appease Hitler. But, you know, I don't blame him for trying, but then he comes out as an idiot. Because he was just trying to avoid war. That's all he was doing. All right, folks. What did we do last week? We checked them off. We dealt with the yearly feasts because it was Easter. That was wonderful. Mm-hmm. And then how Romanism assumed, Roman Catholicism assumed or assimilated pagan cultures. This is something that really happened. It's still happening right to this day, and it even happens with Protestant culture. Protestants have assimilated, since they started, they have assimilated things into Christianity that have nothing to do. They didn't get it from the Bible and what have you. So you've got the move from in Protestant Christianity. You got the move back when they started that was a very evangelical, very biblical based. All the different groups of Protestants were very biblically based. But then after a while, they start doing all these studies, and they come up with different ways of interpreting things, and they began what they started calling modernism. Hey, come on in.
How y'all doing?
Get your rocking chair there, girl.
I know. You can bring a chair over this if you want.
But they started calling it modernism, and it gets all the way up into like the late 1800s, and it had taken over almost all of Protestant denominations. All the Protestant denominations had become modernistic, all the way to the point where they started denying the verbal inspiration of the scriptures, all the way. And that's when the fundamentalist movement starts taking track in the United States, not almost anywhere in Europe, but in the United States, it took hold, this fundamentalist movement. And you had some powerhouses back in those days, fundamentalists. And the fundamentalist movement really turned the tide when it comes to evangelicals, or what we know of as evangelicals now. But it's all still, it's the thing of assimilation. It's where Christianity sort of absorbs its surroundings. And you get confused as to what is and what is not Christianity. I wonder if we're not having that happen right now with so many Christian groups, evangelical groups, getting into politics. And they're, and I mean, they are deep into politics about, say, capitalism or what have you. Christians are, you know, they will take a side on all these political points. And I'm not saying they're wrong. I'm just saying that's not really Christian. It's not biblical. It's not Bible doctrine. And what happens as it morphs, as it is, becomes assimilated into Christianity, it becomes another dogma, another teaching of the church that's not based on the Bible at all. So it's not, we're not trying to just be judgmental, but this started happening from the very beginning. They started building buildings. Did anybody see anywhere in the New Testament where there is a church building? Can y'all think of any example of a church building? A property owned by a church. Now, they were meeting in the school of Tyrannus over there in, was that Corinth? One of those places in Acts, they were meeting in a school of Tyrannus. They were meeting at the very first, they were meeting on the temple grounds. They would say they went to the temple, and that's where they were meeting. And they were preaching, and they were doing that every day. That's where the church would meet. They'd meet on the temple grounds. Remember, the temple wasn't just a little building. The temple was a huge explanada. It was a huge plaza. And they had all kinds of courtyards in that temple area. And so they would go, you know, to Solomon's porch, or they would go to this other place on the temple, and they would meet there. They would meet in people's houses. We know that Rhoda saw Peter when they were in John Mark's mother's house having a prayer meeting. That was in Jerusalem. They were meeting in people's, they were meeting in Priscilla and Aquila's house in Rome. A lot of different places they were meeting, but you don't find any place where the church owned property. And it's transformed the church into a prop. And now listen, this might be normal, automatic, because the church, when it started off, didn't have any political power whatsoever. They did not have any connections. They didn't have any recognition by the empire. There was no way they could say, you know, we've been here a long time and so we have certain rights. They were a brand new startup thing, and so the governors and the people in power, they, as long as they saw them as a group of Jews, another group of Jews, they did have some power because the Jews had some power. But as soon as they became truly distinct from the Jews, they had no power whatsoever, and so they couldn't own property, and they were persecuted. I think that the first church building recorded in history is around the year 240, where we have a document that shows that a church had acquired property. And then after that, we know that the Christians were given plots of land, or they had bought plots of land to bury their dead. They call them the catacombs. And the Christians would bury their dead underground. They didn't have a lot of land. They'd dig deep and they'd bury their dead in these mausoleums underground. And that's still preserved to this day. It's one of the, you know, valuable things. You want to go see something in Rome, you go to Rome and you go to the catacombs and see the inscriptions of the Christians there on the wall, you know. And you'll have certain marks for martyrs and certain marks for other things. Anyway, but this is the only land that they own. Then after Constantine, Christians became the number one religion in the whole empire. And so all of a sudden they have tremendous amount of money. They have a tremendous amount of money and political prestige and power. And so they start having property. And you talk about corruption. It corrupted what the church is. It becomes a system of purchasing properties and expanding properties. They begin to have convents and you know, wineries, and they begin to have tremendous amount of property. And even to this day, all the churches that you know of have, at least in the United States, well, they have property. Very few of them are renting a place or meeting in a home. That's very few. The vast majority of them think. In fact, missionaries, when I started off being a missionary, and my dad was a missionary this way, you go to where you're gonna try to start a church, and the first thing you do is you get some property, you buy some land, you build a building, and you build benches, and you start a church. That's how you do it. That's how we were taught. All the missionaries of the great missionary movement, they would go to a place like China. They go to China and they would start buying property, and they'd buy this property and they'd set up a clinic, or they'd set up a school, or some type of a refugee thing, or a leper colony. It all had to do with, it all revolved around property. But if you read the New Testament, you see that it doesn't hardly mention at all. There is no mention of property owned by a church. All of it was rich people would allow them to use. Like Paul shows up at Troas and they have this upper room, this room that has three lofts, because we know.
I was gonna ask about that.
Yeah, and it's apparently owned by one of the members of the church, or maybe they rented it for their Sunday or what have you. I had a Sabbatarian call me, a Sabbatarian pastor, Sabbath-keeping pastor, call me up and wanted to rent our church on Saturday. Because, they needed a church, and he saw us online and said, yeah, y'all's beliefs match ours except for the Sabbath, except for the Sunday. Y'all meet on Sunday. Since we meet on Saturday, can we rent your place? And I said, well, we've got things going on Saturday, and I just don't think it's going to work. I gave him some other ideas, but if the idea is we own stuff, and our church has been transformed from what the Bible was. The Bible, the church was the people that believed, and they would gather wherever. They would gather in people's homes. Very similar to what we were doing during the pandemic when we started everybody meeting in our homes. Didn't last long because then they prohibited meeting, more than 10 people or whatever, and I'm thinking... And now I wonder if they even have the right to prohibit anything, But we were trying to be conformist and help them out, and try to do our part. But at the same time, we started meeting in homes. That's more or less the way it was done in the Bible. They would meet in the homes. And the power of the church had nothing to do with how much money came in the coffers or how big a building you had or that sort of thing. The power of the church had to do with the kind of preachers you had, the people that got out there and were champions for the faith. That's the power of every church. You'd have some churches that were very strong. And why? Because they had a Barnabas there, or they had an Apollos in that church. And so that church was strong, had a great following. People were following his lead. Then you had other churches, say like in Athens, and you never hear another word about it. You just never hear. You don't even see that it says there was a few disciples there, but no big leader took off, and so that church was weak. But think about how that has changed. Now, maybe it's not wrong. Maybe it's not wrong for us to own a building. In fact, if I thought it was a sin, I wouldn't be having this building. I wouldn't be meeting in it. For our sense, it's convenience. It's a very useful tool to have a building. But I also notice the danger of how much interest, how much time we spend on the building, and how much less time we spend evangelizing or doing something like, home Bible studies or, visitations like the Jehovah's Witnesses do. There's a lot less. I mean, we just get ourselves wrapped up in these material things. How many Saturdays do we spend working at the building, or how many of the hours per week do I spend going up to the building and doing this or changing that or adding this or, fixing something? And we have deacons that do the same thing. And why do we have deacons that are basically janitors? They're supposed to take care of the building. That's what most deacons in most churches are. They take care, except some churches have deacons as board members. If you're a deacon, you're a board member, so you have all the real power. But in the Bible, the deacons, they didn't work on the church grounds. That wasn't what they did. What the deacons did was they were the messengers that took care of the money. Back then, they didn't have banks, so they couldn't just deposit money in somebody's account. Back then, what they had was they would gather up the coins, the money, and then they would hand it to a messenger, and that messenger would be in charge of that money, and he was in charge of taking that money to somebody else and handing it to that person. And they would sign their receipts and what have you and get their you know, the way they did their transactions. But that's the way they did it, and that's what the deacons were. So when, at the very first church in Jerusalem, when the apostles said, look, we're wasting our time trying to mediate between you people who think you're being done wrong, let's appoint somebody to take care of this business so that we can still minister the word, the apostles saw that as a disadvantage. And nowadays, the churches see that as an advantage. The churches see the pastor having the fundraising, you know, and the whole idea is get more money, buy more buildings, buy more goods, and so we can offer services. It is a completely transformed view of what the church is. Look in the Bible and see what the church was. It was just a group of people that believed the same thing, and it didn't matter where they met. They didn't think of where they met as what was important. They could meet out in the park. They could meet in a school. They could meet in somebody's home, or you know, wherever, at the temple grounds. They'd meet anywhere there was a spot, but they never put any emphasis at all in purchasing property. In Mexico, I tried to teach that. It took me a while to come to that conclusion that we didn't need property. When we were first in San Luis Potosí, and Dale was. We were having meetings in his house. It was a real ordeal because we started having 50 or 60 people trying to meet in his house. And, man, his house is about the size of this house, you know. And you try to get that many people. We had them sitting on the stairs. All the kids would sit on those stairs, little narrow stairs about this high. And they would just cram in there on the stairs. We'd have people stacked all the way in and then people standing out of the doorway. It was crazy. So Dale bought some property. Of course, he had the money, so he bought some property, or he I don't know how he did it, but he bought some property across the street, and then we raised up some money and built a building. And the church in Seleni still has that building. And I think they are handicapped because of that building. They are stuck in that building. That's their building. And it's nice. It's been a nice building for a long time, but it's the church plant. But I got to realizing there's no way I'm going to have the money to go to. I was getting ready to leave from San Luis to go to León, and I had a whole different viewpoint of what mission should be. And I realized I don't have the money to buy land, and I'm not going to give these people anything. I'm not going to give them money, because that's like buying converts. If I provide everything for them, then of course they come because it's convenient. I wanted people that came because they wanted to hear the word. And so basically I got real stickler on that, remember, Deb? And so we wouldn't rent a building, and we wouldn't have meetings in our home, and so we just started meeting in a park. And at first, it was a thing that we had just had no other choice. We just started meeting in a park, and then after a while, it was, you know, a few years, but I realized this meeting in a park is not a disadvantage. It causes some people to be embarrassed. It does make people stand out. They're in this park as Christians meeting in a park, so there are some people that just won't come because they're embarrassed, and that is, you lose some people that way. But the people that do come, man, they're real. They come, and we're meeting out in the park, and all of our preaching is public. All of our teaching is public. It's all just public. And we become the center focal point of Christianity in the whole city. We didn't even try. We weren't trying to be the center of Christianity in the city. We were just meeting in a park because we had no choice. But because of the way it worked out, we became the very center of evangelical Christianity in the city of León. And it happened also in Aguascalientes. We became the most visible center of Christianity in the whole town. All these other churches had these little buildings in the colonias, in the neighborhoods. They had these little buildings. And the buildings, because of the laws there, were owned by the government, and so they couldn't sell them or do anything like that to them. They just would apply for permission. They'd build the building, and then it belongs to the government. It was just a strange thing, but the way we did it, it completely freed us, and we expanded by just going to the next park. We take half of our church, say, okay, we're going to be meeting in this park. Took half of the church, they started meeting in another park, another spot of town. And like in León now, there's nine churches meeting in parks. And at the time, we got to thinking, well, you know what, eventually they'll start raising money and they'll be able to buy their own land. And they did. They started raising money, and they bought some land, and but they just never moved. They never... When we left León in 88, and immediately they decided to rent a building. And so they did. They rented a big old warehouse, monster thing. And they would fit in it. It was great. And they loved that place. And then they lost it. I don't know. The guy wanted it back or whatever. So they were there maybe a year. I don't remember exactly. But I don't know. You remember all this, Leslie? You were old enough, right? So, yeah, they were meeting in that park for a while. But now I look back on it and I think, why in the world was I so focused on needing a building? The reason why is because I was taught. That's all I knew. That's all I knew. There was a church building. And that's what you focused on. Everything's the building. We're going to look at this building, make this building this way. And the better pastors were better at building good buildings because they knew. My dad was an expert at building this building because he knew what needed to be done, you know, when you want to make a church building. And of course, now we look at it and say he made some mistakes too. But at the same time, you know, at the time you think, well, I know what we need. We need a building. And that's the way he thought. That's the way I thought. That's the way most Christians thought. But when you really look at the Bible, you see that this was an assimilation. We did something that's not biblical. Now, I don't think meeting in a church building itself is bad. But what happens when the building becomes the temple? It becomes the substitute temple. Remember, all those ancient pagan religions had their holy places. They had their shrines. They had their pyramids. They had their temples. And so when Christianity becomes acceptable in all the empire, the Christianity is acceptable. Well, what happens? They start, you know, having their own buildings, and they assimilate the thinking of these pagans. That this is a holy place. And they even assimilate it from the Old Testament because the temple was the holy place. Even though Jesus made it so clear, this temple is nothing. It's going to be gone. Forget it. And Paul made it clear. And none of them put any importance on the temple at all. But it wasn't long before all Christians were putting importance on that very special place of God, this house of God, which is the temple. And to this day, 99% of Christians meet in a temple that they consider a holy place. Even evangelicals. Now, it's true that a lot of evangelicals do understand that the building is nothing, but look at the lavish buildings they have. Look at that stadium building that Joel Osteen has, or that Crystal Cathedral out in California. Shuler has, or Oral Roberts, and these universities that, like Oral Roberts got a university in Lynchburg, Virginia, and Hiles Anderson, Tennessee Temple, and Moody Bible Institute, and they also do hospitals, and this is all owned by evangelical churches. Tell me that they haven't assimilated the same way. Now, they don't consider these places holy shrines, but that doesn't mean the people that go to them don't think of them that way. Think about it. Even if the pastors would tell their congregation, there's nothing holy about this building, the amount of importance they put, the amount of money they spend on the building, the amount of crutch the building becomes for them, it becomes sort of a holy place. And the people that go to that church, they will whisper to their kids, come on. The church. We're going to dress up. We're going to be different. We're going to this. And going to church means going to that building. Even the word church means a building in English because of that. That is pure assimilation. Has nothing to do with the Bible. What do we take away from it? We have to realize, first of all, that the building is an assimilation. It is a corruption of true, pure, primitive Christianity. The way the apostles left us with a true doctrine. Nothing to do with buildings. No place is holy. You worship God in spirit and in truth, not in this mountain, neither in Jerusalem, Jesus said. God is a spirit. He must be worshipped in spirit and in truth. So why all the importance? Why steeples? Why crosses? Why stained glass windows? Why? And then think about another problem that we have here. Remember, we used to have the Bible in the New Testament is very clear. They had a fairly open meeting. I don't know if it was exactly like our open meeting, but it was somewhat open because, like you read 1 Corinthians 14, clearly an open meeting. But now all of the temples are stadium-like. They have a stage or a front, and all everything else is benches and pews and what have you. And what that does is it guides people into the thinking that it's a one-man show up in the front, and we go there and listen to the man of God speak. That's the idea. And that's not the way it is in the Bible at all. The meetings were much more of an open meeting like this is. You might have some designated speaker, but it was not this formal man of God speaking. You're getting so hot.
I'm okay.
You want to get yourself a fan?
I'm fine.
Anyway, sorry guys, Judy kicked us out, so we had to be over here. I would give Judy a hard time. Anyway, how also does that turn into becoming a holy place? And it did become a holy place. Although, I don't even have a verse of scripture to take you to. The only verse I could think of is that one that says, these men are neither robbers of churches. And that's really talking about pagan idol temples. And that's what happened. These temples became churches. And the churches were the buildings, and that's not Christianity at all. That is not what the Bible teaches. But what happens when you start focusing on buildings and things like that, and a holy place, a shrine, a place where God is? God's in the temple. We live our lives out here. God is in the temple. I can't tell you how much of that thinking pervades the people I minister to in Mexico, and I assume it pervades here too. We dress up and we go to church and we watch our tongue. When we were over here, we were eating tacos with our grandkids up here at this Roberto's Tacos. I don't think it's Roberto's Tacos anymore. They went out of business. But we went by there and got tacos, and I had Presley and Hannah. I don't remember who all we had. Maybe Connor. They were little. And there was a family over there, like three or four couples of adults. No kids, but they were there. They were drinking and they were eating their tacos. And they started cussing, effing this and that. They weren't quite arguing. They were just talking filthy. They'd had a little too much to drink. And I said, okay, we just got to go. So I took the kids out. We took the kids out and left. And I just walked over to them and I said, hey, guys, just wanted to let y'all know we had to leave because we had children here. And y'all were using such filthy language that we can't keep our kids here in a public place with you guys talking like that. And one of the women immediately said, oh, I am so sorry. She said that. And the man got mad and he said, well, this ain't an effing church. Now think about that. You don't speak like that in church. What, you think God's not here? That's the stupidest thing. That's the stupidest statement he could make. This isn't a church. I wouldn't cuss like that if it was a church.
Yeah.
Well, why not? Why wouldn't you cuss like that if it's a church, you know? God doesn't have any problem with the way you talk. Anyway, the whole idea is there's a holy place, and that place we can leave God. God is basically imprisoned in that little spot, and then we can live however we want out here, and when we need God, we'll go to that spot that we've put him in. You're like a canary in a cage. We'll go over there, and we'll talk to him there. But he's not allowed to come out here and look at us. That is just a complete wrong thinking. And it's pervasive among so-called Christians. That leads to another problem. The idea of a shrine, you begin to have competition between shrines. Some churches, it has to do with, you know, if you have a city and you've got 12 big churches in the city, and you got a priest or you got a pastor or whatever in these churches, what have you, and The only competition is who's going to come to their church and start giving money to their church. That's the competition that there is. Well, you need a hook. You need some way to get people to come to your church. So what happens? The first thing that happened was relics. I don't even know if it's first. I'm speaking out of turn. I don't really know which was first. I just know they started having relics. They would say, this church over here has an actual piece of the cross. And they have a little piece of wood, old junk piece of wood, and they'd have it, you know, encased in glass, whatever, at the front of the church. And so people would go to that church so they could get near to a piece of the actual cross. They started Every church realized that this is the way they get people. It really made people come. So all the churches had to have relics. They all had, they'd have bones. They'd have Mary's breast milk. They'd have hair. They would have, They would have tears. They would have whatever it is. They would have fabric. They would have the Shroud of Turin. They would have, all of these things became draws in their temples for people to come to because of these holy sites that they could get then God to answer their prayers or they'd get their miracles done. All of this came about because of this mistaken notion about a holy place. And that came about because they started having money and they start buying property and all their focus becomes on their property. Now we've tried to mitigate that. We've tried to eliminate that. We know we're not supposed to, you know, venerate any of this junk. And we know that the temple is nothing. And yet, at the same time, we're committing the same mistakes that the early Christians did when they first started having money and they first started having some convenience and some political power and they bought some property for their convenience. This property, we're making the same mistake. How do we know that our kids don't have this feeling that, oh, we go to church and that's what we do there and that's not fun, but we go to the lake and that's fun, you know, or we go to the movie house and that's fun. And it creates this dichotomy, this division between their experiences. And it's because we have a building set aside for our worship. I wonder if the best thing that could happen to Christians is that they lose all their political power and lose their financial power and forced to start meeting at homes again. That might be the best thing to happen to Christianity since they first started this. Then they get into special places and special graveyards. Because you get shrines. Certain martyrs died and they're buried and they build a church there. And so this martyr's bones is right there. So Justin or Papias or Irenaeus or whatever, they're buried here or whatever. And you get like Mother Teresa, she's buried in a certain spot. And there'll be pilgrims going there to that place. And this has happened all over the world. This is a corruption, pure corruption, that you can trace from this concept of a holy place. You think about how innocent it is to just want a place to meet conveniently that you don't have to constantly be resetting up your chairs. Because if you've ever had meetings in your home, you know the inconvenience. Yeah. All you have to do is just have a Bible study like this in your home. This isn't much because we don't really roll out the red carpet for you guys. But some, you know, if you have a good number of people coming, it becomes a chore every meeting day to roll out everything, clean up everything. Got to clean the bathrooms, got to clean the kitchen, got to vacuum and mop. You got to, you know, do it. Put all the chairs up and get ready to go. And then people start showing up and then you have your meeting and then you have to put it all back to normal. It is a pain. That was the reason why Dale bought a piece of land.
I was in a home ministry like that. We took turns setting up the chairs and they would have to call in, do you have any visitors today? Because I don't want extra chairs out.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But think about how convenient it is to say, look, we have enough money. Let's just buy a place and let's make that dedicated for our meetings, which is what we've done. Is there any possibility that there's something wrong with that? There's not. There's nothing wrong with it. I can't think of anything wrong with, since we have the money and we have the privilege, we have the freedom, let's just spend the money for our convenience and have a place that we know where we're going to meet. It's great. But then when you look at historically what happened because of their desire for convenience, this is devastating. Christianity has been devastated by this concept of a building. Then you get to images. The martyr's bones, the holy place, the shrine, the relics, all that stuff. All that's really bad. But then you get to, well, besides the martyr, after the martyrs come saints. When you had the Romans had a god for every day of the year. Just like they had a special god for every day of the week. The special gods were the first day, the first most important god was Sol, which was Sunday. So we have Sunday, that's the first day of the week. That's the big heavenly god out there, it's the sun. Then you have the moon, that's Monday. Then you had, Tuesday, they call it Mars Day in their ancient Romes, and then you still have that in Spanish. It's called Martes, which is the day of Mars. And then we have Wednesday. Mars in English it's turned into Tuesday, which is some Teutonic god or some Scandinavian god's name that corresponds to Mars. Wednesday is called Miércoles in Spanish. That's Mercury. That's Mercury. Mercury Day, that's one of the planets. And then you have Mercury. After Mercury comes Viernes, that's Venus.
Jueves.
I'm sorry, Jueves. Jueves is Thor, which is Jupiter. Jueves is Jupiter. But which is the planet? Oh, yeah, Jupiter, that's the planet. Because back then they said they had seven planets. There were seven planets. There was the Sun, the Moon, Mercury, Mars, Venus, Jupiter, and Saturn. Those were your seven planets. So you had 7 days of the week. So they just named the Saturn is the last day, Saturday. Anyway, they had special gods for every day of the week. They had special gods for every month of the year. And they had Janus, January, and March, I guess, would be Mars. I'm not sure. But then you had one god for every single day of the solar year. And the Catholic Church did exactly the same thing. They just took those days, and they realized we can't honor these gods. And these Catholics were sincere. Back before there was a Roman Catholicism, there was a Catholicism. It was the Catholic Party. It was basically basic Christianity with these corruptions that had come in. And they had these days that were celebrated, and so they just said, well, there's nothing wrong with that if we just make it about Christian things. And so they became Christian saints. And so they would have a day for St. Peter and a day for St. Paul and a day for St. Thomas and all St. Joseph and St. Mary and St. There was a day, September the 8th, day of St. Mary's, 25th of March, day of St. John. And you might know some of these days, St. Valentine, February the 14th, St. Valentine. And all of these saints were given a special significance. Valentine was the saint for lovers, and St. Nicholas was the saint for thieves and children. And you had a saint for everything. And that's the way that... But where does this come from? It comes from assimilating the idea of the Romans that had a saint, that had a god for every day. And they just replaced these gods with saints. Then you come to images. They began to have images, and there was a big fight back around the year 400, 500 on the eastern side. You had what they called the iconoclasts. Christians began to be really against images in worship. And so these iconoclasts, they would go and they would break all the images. They'd go find a church and they'd bust all the images because they said you're not supposed to have images. And that lasted. This was a big fight in the East all the way till about the year 800 when some empress over there in the East came down on the side of images and persecuted, ran off the iconoclasts and stopped that nonsense. So from then on, Roman Catholicism has had images, has had idols. I mean, these are like little dolls and you find them everywhere, and they are, it's an amazing type of an art form that can just, it actually sickens me when I see it. It's like, it's not good art. It is, but it has a certain pathetic appeal to certain people. I don't understand it. I don't get it. We're not talking about really good paintings or really good sculptures. We're talking about very pitiful things. And then they claim that these things can do miracles. And the only reason they do that is because if they do miracles, more people come to their church. And so there's like a competition on who's image does the most miracles. It was a huge thing in Mexico because La Virgen de los Remedios in San Juan de los Lagos, her day was February the 2nd, the day of the Candelaria, candle mass, they call it in English. That virgin became very, very, it's a little one of those triangular virgins like they have in the ancient Babylon. If you ever read Two Babylons by Alexander Hislop, you see all the drawings of the ancient Babylonian virgins. and it's exactly the same. It just looks the same. This little triangular Virgin over there in San Juan. And early on, I mean, back in the 1700s, this Virgin was doing miracles. And people were, they were, millions of people were going to this San Juan de los Lagos, an aldea in the middle of nowhere. I mean, long way from Mexico City, long way from everything. They would travel there, and it became extremely famous. And the people in Mexico City began to say, we've got to compete. And that's when this legend of the Virgin of Guadalupe comes up. And so then you have competing legends. Then you have the Virgen de Zapopan over there in Guadalajara. They had to have their Virgin. And I don't know all the other ones, but every little aldea has their own Virgin. We went to this, I don't know if I told you all that story, but this one little town didn't even have a paved road to it, but it was a stop along the railroad track. They called it Estación Bocas. And the town was there, about 3,000 people, had a nice school and a bunch of nice buildings and a big warehouse for grain. And so it was like a central place for all the farmers in the area. And it had this one nice-sized capilla, a chapel, up on a hill with grados, with the steps, big steps. Like one step would be the width of this porch. And went way up. And on every step on the side, there'd be a little opening, like a little hut for selling things. And so they'd be selling little images, or they'd sell tortas, or they'd sell whatever. But it's a long thing there, and it was a whole big production. We preached out there and had big crowds. It was something else. But we went to this place, and I talked to the people there. I don't remember if I talked to the priest or not. But they said, yeah, this new priest came, and he had this kid that saw this 10-year-old kid, some campesino out there, came and he brought a rock, and there was a hole like drilled in the rock. I don't know if they drilled it or if it was a natural hole in that rock. It was a rock about that size, had a hole in it, and the kid looked in the hole and saw the Virgin. And they had the rock down in the basement underneath the altar. You could walk down by steps to look at it, and it was encased in glass. There's this rock, and the hole's facing you, and they say if you have enough faith, you look in that hole, you'll see the Virgin. And this caused that thing to become a huge church, like a big temple with, those domes, those spires, and all the, I'm sure it was just paint, but it was all painted gold, and it was just huge. And they were making tons of money, and they were selling these little retablos, these, what would you call them, Thanksgiving plates, like little squares that these people would paint. And you would buy one of them to leave at the altar as a thanksgiving to the Virgin for having done some miracle. And so it was just a huge marketplace. All of that came from something so innocent as we want to have a convenient place to meet. That's where all that stuff just evolved right out of that. You guys can see then the danger of small compromises.
So along the way, there must have been some people, some men that stood up and said, this is...
All along the way.
So who was one that you read about?
The Archbishop of Milan withstood Ambrose. He withstood a lot of that stuff.
Now, he was the Archbishop in the Catholic Church.
Yes. Wait. There was no Catholic Church back then. There was no organized... Remember, a lot of these... There was a group that was saying of the primacy of the Pope. The Bishop of Rome, they considered to be primacy because they wanted a unified Christianity.
Right.
And that was one of the parties. That you might consider that the Roman Catholic Party because they wanted primacy. But most of the other, like the churches in the East, would never consider the Pope of Rome, the Bishop of Rome, to be their head. And I know that no place in Ireland or England did. And none of these other places in North Italy did. They were very independent-minded. But the Bishop of Milan, for a long time, resisted all of this nonsense. You had the Paulicians in the East that resisted all this nonsense. Then you had the Waldenses in the north of Italy, and they resisted this nonsense pretty strictly. When, by the time of Gregory the Great, Roman Catholicism became... very powerful. Roman Catholicism, where the Pope is the head of everything, they became very powerful because Gregory the Great was really quite a character. He was actually a pretty good guy, as far as Roman Catholics go. And he established, he was against idolatry. He was against the real idolatry of, you know, worshiping the sun. He tried to change things like the way they would bow down toward the sun rising. They would, in the mornings on Sunday, they would all bow down to the sun at the sun rising before they'd go into the temple. He would rail against that. He was trying to reform the church according to his Catholic beliefs. Remember, Roman Catholicism after the Counter-Reformation is different than Roman Catholicism before the Reformation. It was a smorgasbord before. A lot of different beliefs, a lot of different factions. And you had a bunch of reformers before that. And even outside of the Reformation, there were many reformers. After the Reformation, Roman Catholicism became monolithic with a certain set of strict dogmatic beliefs, and nobody could dissent, yeah, or they burned you at the stake.
And when did they start? Like, I see people, you know, they do a cross like that whenever they see a building.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know anything really about that. I don't know what it means. I mean, I know they're blessing themselves or crossing themselves.
That's been going on in my family for years. They drive in front of them, and all they're doing, when I say all they're doing, what they're doing is they're recognizing the church as what they think it is, a holy deal. And they're recognizing.
What does that do for them? Or is it just like a, like we would take off our hat to pray, that sort of thing?
Yeah, it's kind of a sign of respect, I guess, but it's
real superstitious sometimes. They do it. I worked with guys that did it when they were about to do something dangerous.
Baseball.
Even when they were about to do something.
It's like a prayer.
Yeah. Someone would do it when they were going to steal.
Did you see that one? Did you see that one on the news? Where they took this guy in the news, and he had this camera, this security camera, and the guy goes up there, and he's jimmying the lock on the front door, and he finally breaks it open. And then he stops, and he looks around, and then he crosses himself, and he runs inside. It was hilarious. They had it on the news.
That works.
Well, I'm sure he's promising to give God a tenth.
Oh, God.
Yeah, it's like when they would go to family for dinner or something, and then they'll bless the food, the sign of the cross. And
what did they say at the end of the prayer? All of them said it together.
Most Catholics, I mean, you'll see it on Blue Bloods when they pray, Blessed is the Lord, and these I guess. And, it's the same repetitive prayer. I grew up with it.
Yeah.
But it was like it was pointed out to me here a while back, and I don't even know where it came about. But if you take the measurement in the way that they do the sign of the cross, it's actually an upside-down cross.
Oh, right.
Because from here to here,
yeah.
And it's longer, here, so you're actually doing an upside-down cross. And I was just like, is there really something? I mean, just doing the sign of the cross is something. Yeah. But then to claim that it's upside down, it's like, you know.
Well, let me ask you guys something then. What is wrong with, say, the cross as a symbol? What is wrong, say, with a crucifix? Catholics have a crucifix, and they have Jesus hanging there on the cross. What's wrong with having a picture of the Virgin Mary?
Because they almost always begin to pray to it instead of a living God.
But what if they insist? We never pray to it. It just helps us to remember.
Well, I remember Galatians talked about, I believe it's Galatians, the cross being a curse.
That's true. The cross is a curse. And the reason why Romans killed malefactors on crosses was as an offering to the god Tau, Tammuz, using as the first letter. That's a Babylonian thing. They got it from the Babylonians, and so the crucifixion was a cursed offering to this god Tammuz. I don't know that they thought of it in a religious sense. I think the Romans looked on it as a way of truly desecrating somebody, to truly shame them. Mm-hmm. was very humiliating and very torturous. Just hang them there and let them starve to death, hanging on a cross. Very, very difficult.
Yeah, and I don't understand. I mean, like I said, I grew up in the church, and I really don't understand why they leave an image of a man hanging on a cross. Because it is very twisted and perverted in my mind. Coming out of it, look at when I was going to church, it just, that's just the way it was. And even when I started going to Oak Knoll, I used to wear a mariner's cross or crucifix. It was a ship's wheel with an anchor, and then it had a cross, you know, cross built into the anchor with an image of a man on it. And that's when I got away from everything. But when I look back at Catholicism the way that I feel about it now, to me, with the sacrificing of Christ in every Mass and stuff like that, I think maybe it has something to do with their sacrificial offering that they're doing. Because when I look at somebody that's a Christian and they wear just a cross, I think they see the cross. I think that people can look at the cross and go, it reminds me that they took Christ off of the cross, yeah. And I don't know how you would wear something to remind you of an empty tomb, but they can look at it and say, Christ is risen. And that's just a thought.
I don't criticize the Christians that wear a cross. I won't do it, though.
Right.
It creeps me out, the idea of having that kind of a symbol, and the fact that the cross was a tremendous humiliation for Christians in the Bible.
And the thing is, it's like you say that a video camera caught a guy breaking in, he makes a sign of the cross. Well, it's the same thing. If a man's out there wearing a cross around his neck, like some of these rap stars do, or movie stars, or even just
like the devil.
Exactly. And they're wearing the cross outside their shirt where everybody can see.
But what would be the difference between wearing a cross on your shirt and having a fish on the back of your car? I'm just getting y'all to think it over because
it's the exact same thing. It's just a different symbol.
To me, it would be a cross is a real personal, it's a real grievous thing that you do, and a fish just doesn't carry that kind of weight to me. That's just me.
Yeah, you know, but I think. But what is the essential difference?
The difference is that the cross is like, I would only think that you should use that symbol very sparingly because of what Jesus had to go through on that cross.
Well, and not only that.
It's not fun to be just lightly made into jewelry like you do everything else.
Well, but see, the Bible does say, and I won't glory in anything but the cross. I'm going to glory in the cross of Christ.
Pick up your cross and
take up your cross. The cross in the Bible is mentioned many, many times as something truly valuable to a Christian. Although the crucifixion was a source of true, what do you call it, embarrassment for the apostles. I don't know if you notice it. They always say he was crucified once. It's never going to happen again. Once.
Well, maybe I'm crashing my thinking because I see it as a, I hate it. You know, I don't like the movies that glorify the whipping of Jesus and all that stuff. I hate that stuff. I think it's focusing on the wrong thing. And I know he did it for me, but I can't stand the idea of making money off of him, his suffering on that. That's just, it's not what you do to a friend. If you gave your life for me, and you did it over there on that boat, I don't know if I'd wear the boat around, you know, to signify that I was remembering you, because say it didn't have to go down that way. I mean, it was just, maybe I'm still getting over the fact that he had to die for me. That's my sin, you know, the cross, but he rose again, you know. That's the, you just say, well, what are you going to wear then? You can't wear an empty tomb. Well,
I'm wearing an empty tomb right now.
Yeah, I don't know what you wear, but
we're all wearing it.
But if you had to wear anything, it ought to be something that, because that cross wasn't the end of it. It wasn't.
You know, I agree with all of that, but wait a minute.
That is like the
you have Catholics and you have even Protestants and even evangelical Christians. The only ones I know that will never put a cross on are Jehovah's Witnesses. They will not. They are very against that. They don't think he was crucified. They think he died on a stake.
I got a question for you.
Well, let me finish my thought here.
Well, you asked the question about the fish on the back of the car.
Okay.
Between that and a bumper sticker.
You have a K drive or whatever. I mean,
what's the difference between a fish,
the sticker of a fish on the back of a car, and a Christian sticker, a bumper sticker?
Yeah, but one's a symbol and one's not.
But you are saying you're Christian. Is what I'm saying.
Yeah. Well, this is what I was going to say. That's
co-pilot.
That's the argument.
Sticker like that, or
well, anything to signify that you're.
See, I think that what you're getting into is now you're getting into merchandising for the money, whether it's a cross, because a lot of people that want a cross, they go to a very nice jewelry store, they spend good money on James Avery,
yeah,
one of the biggest deals. Others like maybe a church, Catholic church, or even a regular Christian church might have a small jewelry store with earrings or something as a form of, say, money, or for the kids or something as they're growing up, their baptism or whatever it may be. Whether it's a, not immersion, but a, say like a 7 to 10 year old kid got baptized on this day and they wanted a cross to remember that day. But like the fish on the back of a car, somebody decided, well, hey, the cross is pretty much marketed. Let's come up with a fish. We could do the fish, Fishers of Men, and we can make a little more money on that. And then what's the next?
Yeah, I don't think that's it, though, Robert. I think the reason why evangelicals went to a fish is because they didn't want to be considered Catholic, and the cross had become a symbol for the Catholic faith. So yeah. Protestants during the Protestant Reformation rejected all Christian symbols. They rejected crucifixes and crosses, and they thought of that as breaking one of the commandments. You know, thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image. And that's another point that I'm asking you when I ask you this. What is wrong with a fish? What's wrong with a cross? How about those commandments that say don't make any graven image? These are part of the Old Testament law, but it does say in that Old Testament law, don't do any of this kind of thing because it's an abomination to God. And even God in Deuteronomy 4 says, I appeared to you in a cloud, but there was no shape in the cloud. And the reason why is I didn't want you to make an image of that shape. So God has something wrong, something against, at least in the Old Testament, He had something against making shapes that symbolize your religion, your faith. And in my mind, that is a good enough argument for me that I'm not going to have any symbol that's going to be a symbol of my religious faith.
Not a dove.
Not a dove. Not anything. Or a picture of Jesus.
Well, because if you have the Spirit descending upon Jesus when He's baptized as a dove.
Right, but I wouldn't make a dove, and you know, and I know people do. Let me give full disclosure here. I'm not such a fanatic about it that I would cause a problem with any Christian. I've even bought ties that have a cross on them because you know they have a scripture verse on them,
yep.
And because I want to wear a tie that has a scripture verse on it. I'll have to put up with sometimes they'll put a little cross in there. I'm not going to mark it out with a marker, you know.
Well, see, that's the other thing I was thinking about, too. It's like a person that wears a cross, or you wearing a tie with a verse on it. A person sees the cross or sees the tie with a verse on it. In a way, it gives you an opportunity to put the gospel out there, or it gives you the opportunity to say, hey, I'm a Christian, and if you have a question, I might be able to help you, or if you have a question about what I believe, you know, and it could be the same with the cross or with a tie.
It could be. I mean, it's true that in the United States, the cross came to symbolize Catholicism, and Protestants avoided it. In Mexico, though, we preached with great success on, you know, the second commandment, thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image,
right.
Because they have hundreds of graven images, and they bow down to them, and they thank them, and they do processions in honor of them, not of the thing it represents, but of the image itself. They think they do miracles.
They do it here in this country, but it's very subtle, because what they do is when they walk in the front door of that church, and they're walking toward the altar, and they're getting ready to get into their pew, they will, almost all of them, will genuflect
there, at
and then get in. And they're bowing down to the altar and to the crucifix, you know. And then when you go to a Catholic church, like Easter, you know, we don't go to a Catholic church on Easter, but they have a lot of the image, there are other stuff that they always have, the statues or image idols, whatever, but they'll have cloth up there, and it'll have a white dove on it with an olive branch, and they'll have other things to do each one of the rabbit stuff. But.
Well, Protestants have gotten very close to doing all the same thing. Protestants will have now sometimes a cross on their steeple. But for a long time, Protestants would not do that. They wouldn't have a they wouldn't have a cross on the steeple.
In fact, that's changed a lot during my life.
Now,
30 years.
It's becoming less and less difference between the way they practice.
But as you were talking about the old church back in the apostles meeting in houses and stuff like that, you're talking about a town with a smaller population covering a smaller area, where now you're in a time where you've got a city of 2 million people. You've got a neighborhood with all kinds of different buildings shaped, and our church is a plain-looking building. It could be a lawyer's office. It could be a doctor. You have to read the sign. But when you have a steeple, a person is
automatically, you know.
There's a church. The first time I went east of Texas 20-something years ago, and I got out into Kentucky, and it's like on every corner there's a white church with a steeple on it, and it's like, well, I know where the churches are, you know. And to me, I mean, I never really thought about it till today, but whether it's our church, it's where it's at because it's convenient for a lot of people. We have people coming from the northeast side, the southwest side, all over town to this one church. But they all come for one reason, and that's to worship God the way that we're taught to worship in that church, and that's what we like. Where you have John Hagee's church, there's still people coming from all over, but it's a bigger church. There's more money involved in it. They have more upkeep. They charge more money because of their school. They have probably, I'm assuming, people on duty at least during the day to maintain the building, sweep, clean.
Oh yeah, they have a full-time staff.
You know, and Danny Kennel, Concordia, he works for them, and it's basically a Christian school, church, whatever. So I think it's...
Yeah, but what's the point then about the images, though? How Roman Catholicism began to really focus on images, and how Protestant churches are going sort of that direction.
I think it's personal choice for the people themselves, just like I was telling you. I used to wear a crucifix, and now I don't. I don't wear anything. I wear a watch and a ring. But I think a lot of it is it's personal choice, and it's just that...
But do you not think that there is something wrong with it?
Yeah, there is something wrong.
What about...
I believe there is because, one... People do tend to focus.
But not biblically. You're not thinking about some Bible verse that you're focusing on, or it's just
when I think about
sense of morality.
Idols and not necessarily the cross, but I think that when people get involved in it, even the cross, maybe. Say a person is sitting there and they're just, you think they're playing with it. They may be sitting there holding it and praying, thinking that it has a little bit of extra power in it.
But what do you think about it? Is there a verse in the Bible that would sway you one way or the other with it?
As to it being wrong?
Right or wrong?
Well, the second commandment, for one, but then also...
But the second commandment would include the fish.
Yes, but in the New Testament... the image of the unknown God. Well, I think with Paul, he comes in and told him, this is the God that we're talking about. It's Jesus.
Yeah, but I don't think Paul would in any way would have approved that image.
Right. No. So you're asking for approval. I think it's accepted. I don't know that it's approved.
It's become a point of profit as well. Because you see, businesses put a fish on their signs now as a logo. Say, hey... Giving you the impression they'll treat you right, that they won't.
Well, there's a guy in our neighborhood. There's nothing Christian about him, and he has it on his, and it's because he knows he can get a job with that emblem. Oh. Mm-hmm. So
So it becomes meaningless.
It works on certain people. So some people buy into it because it's got that image.
Yeah. You're more.
Come on,
your...
David. Do you have an image on your little truck there?
You have that little fish.
It's a Frontier.
I would feel so weird doing
it's
that.
It's a Nissan Frontier symbol.
No, when I got saved, I went back to Pennsylvania. One of the first things to do, I went back to Pennsylvania. Me and my little brother, he got saved too, and we went back. And we told our family back to all Catholics, you know, staunch Catholics, and told them about. Get saved and asking Jesus into your heart and give him a new life and a living God. And they were just blown away. Nobody had ever witnessed them before. And they finally got their feet under them, and they all started pulling out their little pictures and their little crucifixes, and each one had a story. I remember my uncle especially, because his story was the best, and how he had that. They have these little, like, they look like baseball trading cards. But you know what I'm talking about? They're a saint.
Right.
And he had one that he had with him in the war or something, and it was just quite the story. And I remember thinking, and I told him at the end of the story, I was like, yeah, but that's just a picture. Mm-hmm. Well, his whole story didn't involve anything with knowing Jesus. It was all about that this picture, he prayed on it the night before the battle, and all this good stuff had happened. Mm-hmm. And it was always that was the focus, and I see that. And he was an intelligent man, but you know, I think it's so easy that we're not supposed to do the graven image thing.
The Old Testament is really, really clear. The Jews understood it. You're not to have any graven image.
Yep.
And so all the Jews, the church started off with no graven images because it started off with Jews, and they would not have graven images. They wouldn't have any kind of image, not even of God. They wouldn't have had an image of Jesus. And God, in the Bible, doesn't give us even a description of Jesus.
Yeah.
We don't know what color his hair was or, you know, how long it was. Or
the whole cross, fish thing, whatever, it all comes down to God is spirit, therefore you must worship him in spirit.
Yeah.
So why have anything at all
other
than...
Yeah, but my question isn't why should we. I'm saying, is there a principle here, biblical New Testament principle, that says... Just like those Jews in the Old Testament, you cannot have an image. You should not have an image, which would include a fish. It would include a picture of Jesus, you know, the praying Jesus or all these other pictures of Jesus. And it would include any other kind of picture, a dove or anything like that, if it's the same as the Old Testament.
So if we, let's say we have a symbol, we're wearing a cross or a fish or whatever, and it doesn't mean anything to us, nothing at all. But somebody else sees it. Can't we become a stumbling block to them if that cross really means something holy to them? Couldn't we become a stumbling block?
Absolutely, and there are verses about becoming a stumbling block. But the only way it's a stumbling block is if it's wrong. If it's wrong to have a cross, then we're a stumbling block because they're having a cross and they become emboldened by our having a cross. You'd have to show that it's wrong first.
But
and I can show it with the Old Testament. What I'm asking is, what's the scriptural principle in the New Testament? Because it's not in the Bible. We don't find anywhere in the New Testament any church, any Christians having images, giving any importance to image.
Yeah, I think, I thought that the scripture he gave in Acts 17 about Paul mentioning to the unknown God, and he mentions that don't think that you can make God with your hands and make any kind of thing.
He is not honored by man's hands. Well, let's read that.
And I think it's Acts 17.
Yeah, it's in Acts 17, that's a quote of Stephen in Acts chapter 7. But in Acts 17, he says, neither is God that made the world, verse 24, and all things therein, seeing that he is Lord of heaven and earth, dwelleth not in temples made with hands, neither is worshipped with men's hands, as though he needed anything, seeing he giveth to all life, breath, and all things, and he made all men. All right, so that is a statement of Paul that God is not worshipped with men's hands. So what we can fashion with our hands, God rejects. So that is one perfectly good verse that would indicate that. I'm also thinking about Acts 19. Where it says that Demetrius stands up. Let me see if I can find this. He stands up in there and he says, verse 24 says, a certain man named Demetrius, a silversmith, which made silver shrines for Diana, brought no small gain unto the craftsmen, whom he called together with the workmen of like occupation and said, Sirs, ye know that by this craft we have our wealth. Moreover, ye see and hear that not alone at Ephesus, but almost throughout all Asia, this Paul hath persuaded and turned away much people, saying that they be no gods which are made with hands. So that not only this our craft is in danger to be set at naught, but also that the temple of the great goddess Diana should be despised. Now, what he's saying here is, we're going to lose our craft if people believe Paul, because he's telling them not to buy our little images, our little shrines to Diana. So they were making these little silver, shrines, these monuments for Diana, and selling them. And Paul was causing a problem, enough of a problem that he gathered them all together and said, we got to stop this Paul. So, scripturally, biblically, it's clear in the Old Testament without a doubt. And in the New Testament, it's repeated. And I think there are more verses than that. Now, this is just some that we just come up with right here. And I wanted to give y'all a chance to come up with more. But it's clear to me that Paul was teaching and all the apostles were teaching the same thing the Jews taught. You're not supposed to have these images and think of them as images of God. Now, that's the problem with images, because people think of them as images of God. What about if they are images of, say, Mary? What's wrong with having an image of Mary?
Well, that's the problem, because as you're talking about it, and whether it's a cross, a fish, an image of Mary, what's going to be the next one? I mean, the Catholic Church is a perfect example, because it's paganism, Judaism, and Christianity all rolled into one. And they've picked up their saints and the things that they bow down to, pray, worship, whatever you want to call it, whatever they want to deny. But the thing is, they've picked up all of these saints from other religions. And it's just like in the Old Testament when they would go to war, and they're told, don't take these images or anything of it, leave it, and yet some people would see the value of it or take it. And even if it was a little god.
Well, remember what we read last week, and it said that you shall utterly detest it. You can't even take the gold off of it and melt it down.
And it's like now when I go into a Catholic church, I see all of these images, and I don't think of them the way I used to. I mean, I go in there now, and it's like these are idols. And people are praying to Mary. I mean, I could lose a relative tomorrow, go to a memorial service, which they call a rosary, and they're going to sit there and pray to the Our Father, and they're going to sit there and they're going to do their little prayers to Mary, and they're giving credence to her, and whether they want to admit it or not, if you give credence to her, you're worshiping.
But praying to Mary, and I realize that is worship. If you pray to somebody, that's a form of worship. One time they would tell me, no, we don't worship Mary. We venerate her, but we worship God. And I would ask them, okay, what's the difference? What do you do to God that you don't do to Mary? And they could never come up with anything. There's nothing that they do to God that they don't also do to Mary. Yeah. So there's no practical difference between what they do to Mary and to do to God. But besides the fact that we're not supposed to be venerating Mary and these other apostles the way they do, and I'm not saying we shouldn't respect them or remember them fondly or what, I don't know, but not have a day to honor them and not pray to them. But besides that, what about the images? Because I talk with Catholics all the time, and in Mexico, I didn't have a problem. I just told them, these are evil, these are wrong, stop it. But now I'm working with people that I can't just walk away from and say, you people are idolaters, you're wrong. I have to work with them, so I've got to keep a relationship with them. I've got to be kinder to them and more understanding. I'd like to know what the argument is from an empathetic standpoint, this woman has a picture of the Virgin of Guadalupe around her neck.
Let's take a different approach. What is the difference between what you're talking about, or a rabbit's foot, or a coin, because you're talking about this?
Well, to me, there's a difference.
They kiss. I've seen them have their little crucifix on, kiss it like it's a form of luck.
Like a talisman, yeah.
Yeah, so you're not.
There's no doubt that there are people that do it that way, but I think it's even worse, because I think they think of these images as having some kind of In fact, they will take an image. They'll buy it from the store. They will take it to the priest, have the priest bless it. They have to pay the priest to bless the image so they can pray to it.
Some people even do that with crosses, though, too. Yeah. Cross. As a Christian.
Yes, they do. I'm telling you.
Well, Jesus asked them, whose face is on that coin?
You turn, yes, you're right, he did. Render light. The actual light. I can't see.
So, in this verse in 24, what's the what it says, dwelleth not in temples made with hands.
Buildings made with hands. God doesn't dwell in those places.
Yeah. Talking about God or us?
No, God doesn't dwell in temples made with hands.
Mm.
He's quoting Stephen there.
Okay.
That's an amazing verse. Maybe when we have a symbol, we start to think we control it somehow. We've got inside power. We've got the edge. We've got this representation. So we look at it. We think without really realizing it, maybe that we've got some sort of
edge
over somebody that
doesn't. We have a statue of Robert E. Lee, and they're wanting to tear it down because he was he was fighting for the Confederacy, and that's fine with me. I don't have any, great love for Robert E. Lee, but I don't ever think of a statue of Robert E. Lee or George Washington or whoever else. I don't think of those as being prohibited by the Bible.
See, I think
because I never prayed to him.
I think of that as what mean these stones.
Yeah.
You know, there was an event there, they stacked some stones. Well, that's Robert E. Lee. There
but it is an image of a man
yes.
that God says, don't make any image.
Right.
But I think he's saying, don't make those images to bow down to them.
And then when you get into Catholicism, and whether it's Mary, Peter, Paul, or St. Nicholas, or Valentine, whatever, you're talking about sharing God's glory.
That's a real good point.
And I think the difference, too, is that those images are not brought to, like, a church for worship. It's, like, out there. And it's not
that related, is also a good point.
It's not related to any kind of religion.
But basically the point is you're not to make any image that is bowed down to. So in my mind, a Buddha in your house, you think it means happiness.
Yeah.
But some people treat that as a very religious shrine.
Yeah.
They're very devoted to these images of Buddha.
And we were invited to a wedding years ago, and they had their service and everything, and afterwards they took roses, and they walk around the side of the altar, and there's an image of Mary up there, and they go up there and they lay roses at the feet of Mary during this marriage ceremony. I mean, to me, that's idol worship.
It is idol. It is idolatry.
You know, but yet that's here in this country. And
but we've got to have it clear in our heads what, and it's got to be something we can declare simply. Why is this not allowed? Why does that offend you that they would take flowers and give it to a statue of the Virgin Mary? You need that clear in your head. What's the reason? What's the scriptural principle involved?
It can go back to because they're sharing glory
that's
deserved to God. Yeah. And if you take it away from God and give it to anything else or anybody else.
Even if it's an image of God.
Even if it's
and if it's an image of somebody that's not God, that's even worse.
Yes, even worse.
And when you get into
glory, you won't share with
when you get into Catholicism, a lot of those images, they were actually gods from a pagan religion before they were brought into the Catholic religion.
All right, so God is jealous about His glory, and you're not to give His glory to anyone else. And Jesus said, "God is a spirit, and they that worship Him must worship Him in spirit and in truth." And God does not dwell in temples made with hands, neither is worship with man's hands. So these are simple principles that are New Testament principles that are clearly against the use of images. So wouldn't that tell us to stop putting fish on our car?
Yes, I think so.
In my mind, it does. It tells me I'm not going to put a fish on my car. I'm not going to have a picture of Jesus, even the good kind, in my house.
Well, it's the same thing if you have a fish on the back of your car. If you're going to be racing and weaving and getting mad and throwing the finger out there because...
That's a different issue, though.
But...
That's the hypocrisy issue.
Yes, but what you're doing is you're damaging the faith that
people... Not if that's not a Christian symbol. Not if we're not allowed to have that symbol. See what I'm saying? If we're saying the symbols are not really Christian, and we're not, and a real Christian is not allowed to have one, yeah. So somebody who has one, we already know what they're not acting yeah. like a Christian already.
Yeah.
But I do get what you're saying, because to the world that is Christianity. To a lost person, that is Christianity. Yeah. So it could they think.
But isn't it really not Christianity?
It's not. But then they'll go to you as if you partook of that same thing, and like. See, he's a Christian. Why do y'all do that? Like, don't link me to him. I don't know who he is.
But I think there's Christians out there, though. I mean, I have
that are confused. Yes,
yeah. I have a Christian friend. She's a sweet Christian, and she collects crosses.
Yeah,
collects
yes.
what?
Crosses.
Oh yeah.
And what about the Bible then? Do you remember your dad talking about going to some house and he had a Bible up on the thing?
Wow. I've seen that also. There's a lot of Christians in Mexico
yep.
that when we would be in our park, and sometimes you just have to put the Bible down there, they would have a conniption.
Yeah.
You can never put the Bible on the ground.
Or just walk into your house and toss it and somebody sees it. What are you doing?
Yeah.
And I know, like in a lot of the Catholics that I grew up with and know, relatives, friends, stuff like that, they would have that great big Catholic Bible. Mm-hmm. And it's sitting right there in a room that's never really used. It's a living room. Mm-hmm. And yet nobody would ever go in there. And it was in my parents' house for years like that. It sat there, but nobody opened it, but it was there. And a few years back, even in Houston, they were building houses and burying Bibles in the concrete slab. And so there's a Bible, that, you know, like it has some magical power. And again, you're taking... You're throwing a superstition out there, but you're lessening the holiness and sanctity of God by doing stuff like that.
I think you're right.
But it's a book. It's God's Word, but it's a book. And when it's old and wore out and tore up, you take it, you throw it away.
That's right.
And you get a new one. And if it makes you feel comfortable and you don't want to throw it away, you can take it. I don't know if you can take it out there and just bury it in your backyard and never be used again. I don't know. If that's what some people want to do, fine. But for me, I've thrown a lot of them away.
It'll grow the fruit of the spirit.
Bury it in your backyard and find out what happens.
One time I had bought this little plaque.
Breeds worms.
And it says, God is good. And I thought, I like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I got it home, and then I looked at it, and I went, that's a cross.
It's still good, man.
Yeah,
it's still good.
It seems like you look at that, and you say, well, that's just really innocent. It's not.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, every little compromise turns into something huge.
Right.
Yeah.
Like the compromise... Yeah. Of owning a piece of land and making it a very important piece of land and focusing on it, that's a compromise. And that means we, here in our church, shouldn't spend too much time focusing on the building.
Yeah.
We shouldn't spend too much money on the building. We shouldn't make it too ornate. Should not be our focal point. I think it already is too much of our focal point just for upkeep.
It's easier to get one than it is to lose one.
I don't understand that. I didn't get that. Easier to get one than
I think. I used to think it's hard to get property, hard to get, you know. But it looks like it's a lot harder to go backwards, get rid of something.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes. You know? Yeah. Well,
most people can get together and scrape up the money and buy a church building. You know, as you see it over and over again.
Well, we're wealthy. We have the means.
Yes. Well, if you watch though, you watch what happens over the years. A lot of those churches, they dwindle. They get old. The building gets emptier and emptier. You know, you see it all over the United States, you know, and that's when I start to realize, wow, it's just a building. It really is just a building.
It now really
it's
is.
An underused building, and they're building another one down the block. You know, it's like, it's this thing about our building.
In Mexico, they have these cathedrals in the center of the big towns.
Yep.
These huge, like in Morelia, it's the second largest one in the Catholic one in Mexico. There's a bigger one in Mexico City.
Yep.
But this is a huge cathedral. I mean, Morelia, right downtown. And I remember Jenny walking with me one time over there, and she said, Dad, don't you think this is just beautiful? Look at this huge. And it is. It's ornate, and it is one piece of architecture, this building. And it has these huge mango trees or something all around the sides of it. It's a gorgeous downtown plaza. And she says, what... Don't you think when God comes back that he's going to appreciate this beauty? And I said, no, he's going to step on it. He's going to crush it and turn it into nothing. Yeah. Leave not one stone on another. And I do believe that he's not honored by these ornate buildings. He is not honored by those things.
The love in one saint's heart will outdo all the...
Outshines that completely.
All the cathedrals in the world. And, well, we can't get it through our heads, so maybe that's why...
But here in this...
Not such a good idea to own
them. Yeah, and here in this country, too, you're meeting in these buildings because of the severity of weather, the constant change, stuff like that. And it's just like now, we put a lot of emphasis on the building, but at the same time, because we've discovered that when you have a parking lot meeting, you take it back outside, a neighbor next door shows up or somebody driving by. So you're having the best of both worlds, I guess, at a point, you know, and as the days get hotter and hotter.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I'm for the convenience. Yeah. I'm for it, and I'm glad we have that kind of means. I just think we ought to be careful that we do not let the compromise get a hold of us so that we start paying too much attention to the building.
Yeah, and I don't really know that that's what we do. We're updating, like, the electricity and stuff. We had a problem with the ceiling and everything like that.
Well, Deb wanted to put a steeple. I'm kidding you.
Well, personally, since you brought up the steeple, I would just like to see a sign added to the east side of the building where the main traffic is. Letting them know that there
is. What this is, yeah. That's true. We could put another sign
up. But.
Because they think it's a bonanza.
You built this building over what? A period of 30 years?
40.
This building?
Yeah.
The building's 40 years old?
Yeah.
Okay.
So 74.
You have an upkeep just like this house. You have to spend money on it. You have to do it. And at the same time that you're making improvements, you take a little paint, you add it here, you change it there, stuff like that, and you have to update. It's like
no, man. I'm not arguing against what we're doing. I'm just saying there is a tipping point where you can start depending and appreciating too much the building.
Yeah.
And I know for a fact that in Mexico, not having a building was a tremendous boon. Mm-hmm. It was a help to our churches.
Yeah.
It becomes a trap.
Yeah. This might be a lame example, but it's kind of like what Paul says.
We don't accept lame examples. Give us a really good
one. She's underselling
about,
it.
Okay,
a married woman and a single woman, how much you can commit to the Lord by being
That's
single.
True.
And so I compare it to what you're saying, how much you can commit to the Lord by just gathering. That's the meeting place.
Yeah, if you don't
the meeting
have
place
the,
doesn't have to be fixed up because you're just going and you're gathering for one.
That's right. There's not a lot of work to do. You just
not
show up
work.
At the park.
Just
and,
show up.
Yeah.
Honey, does that mean that if I spend more time doing stuff around the house for you?
But you're also, when you're comparing Mexico to San Antonio, you're talking, and I not knowing Mexico like you do, I think, too, you're dealing with the amount of people down there that have way, way less than we do. And their expectation may be less. I don't know. I mean, I think everybody wants to do better, but not everybody, even in this country, not everybody has that opportunity. Here we have that opportunity. But yes, the money that we spend on upgrading things that may not be necessary to upgrade,
like
that
chairs.
Money could go to
like soft cushiony chairs.
Oh, that was a good upgrade.
That was a good upgrade for us old folks.
I love this.
When we were young, we sat in those kind of chairs. Yes, sir. Yes.
That's where the church I came from. We were sitting in there. It would be
a
waste. Man, I would get pain before the end of the meeting. I had to sit.
Well,
but if you had pews, which a lot of churches have pews, if you had pews, you would sit there and look at the same wall every week. We can turn ours.
Oh, yeah.
You can't go to Cornerstone and just rotate the room.
Not unless you force those girls to turn them, you can't. I'm telling you, man, they get in a rut and you won't be able to get them to move. Talk to Brian. That guy wants them always facing the same room.
And some of these churches that Christian churches that we go to or see on TV or whatever, whether it's the Crystal Cathedral, I mean, these guys are going up there and they're sitting in chairs that are bigger than any of the
chairs.
Yeah,
like thrones. on a stage, throw-ins on a stage. That bothers me.
There's chairs that ain't even that good in the White House, I'm sure, you know, but yet.
That's silly.
And some of them are just lavish. Some of these preachers are so, they have a prosperity thinking where they think that's God's blessing. God is on my side because he's given me such a successful ministry.
But I'm not talking about prosperity preachers, though. I'm just talking about some of them in general that, the church has gotten big, and that's how they decided to decorate. It's like bigger chair, bigger people, more people.
Higher stage, velvet curtains. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, it's.
And these are good Christians. We're not criticizing them as Christians because they are good Christians. These are good pastors, and yet they have a stage. Yeah. And if you have a stage, you automatically are dividing the church into clergy and laity.
Well, once you put them on a stage, you're raising them up above the rest of the crowd.
It's a problem. That's what I'm saying. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for another time. We love to study your word. We'd like to have some wisdom, Lord. We want to get into those deep waters. That's what we're here for, Lord. I ask you to bless us. Everyone going on their way home and our fellowship afterwards, I ask you to bless us in Jesus' name.
Amen.
All righty. Let me stop this. I think we got cookies inside.
I have a question.
Okay.
Political.
Political?
Political.
it's